Greetings and welcome to a special edition of the Science Podcast. I'm coming to you live, or sort of live, from the exhibit hall of the AAAS 2007 annual meeting in San Francisco, California. Over the next few days, we'll be posting podcasts giving a snapshot of some of the sounds and the science on display here. We'll also periodically give you links telling you where you can go for a bit more information. So keep a pencil and paper handy, and don't go away. First, smart prosthetics. Scientists have been working for decades on prosthetic devices that can overcome some devastating handicaps, ranging from paralysis to blindness. Recently in this arena, the fields of medicine, neuroscience, and engineering have come together to make some potentially dramatic advances on this score by focusing on sophisticated electronic devices that actually plug into the nervous system to restore lost motor or sensory function. These so-called smart prosthetics were the focus of a Friday morning session at the AAAS annual meeting. One of the presenters there, Hunter Peckham, described his group's work in restoring movement to paralysis victims such as quadriplegics.
My work is about electrically stimulating the nervous system of people who have paralysis from central nervous system injuries, injuries to the brain or spinal cord, and using a small levels of electrical stimulation to the peripheral nervous system to activate the muscles to restore function in the case of those paralysis.
Peckham systems work by attaching an externally controlled device with low current electrodes to the spinal column below the area of injury, and thereby allowing the victim to control, through external commands, muscles and motions that have been cut off from the relevant processing centers in the brain. Peckham, who has been working on these problems for 3 decades, notes that advances in both materials and electronics have allowed dramatic jumps in what systems such as his can accomplish.
Technology has increased so fast, so far, now that the computational power, the powering capabilities that we have for these devices are far in excess of something we could have envisioned 20 years ago. The devices that we have now will have battery powered in them. The devices that we made 20 years ago, we had to use a radio coupling to them to power them. So that would be one example. The technology has gotten bigger. The quality of the materials that we use has improved. There was not an industry in this area until the pacemaker industry came about. This is a much finer, any of these applications that we do, you utilize much, much finer structures where we're doing much more intimate interfacing than is done in the cardiac pacemaker. So these materials, these power computation make an enormous amount of difference. And I think the other thing is that we're seeing that especially in the last 20 years, I mentioned that it was only 20 years ago that we did the very first implant. It seems like yesterday, but the improvements of those were, that was a very simple rudimentary hand system. Now, with the additional processing capability and these new materials, etc., we can do a lot finer control on the interfaces to the nervous system, and so we're really able to look at a dimensional improvements in the quality of what we can provide, what we can restore.
Of course, the holy grail for restoring movement to paralysis victims would be a system that took instructions directly from the brain, rather than from an external device. John Donahue of Brown University is working on such a system, dubbed BrainGate. The basic principle, according to Donahue, is to use electronics to pull the brain signals into the outside world and allow those imported signals to control external devices.
What we're trying to do is develop an interface system, a neural interface that takes the brain signals for movement and brings them to the outside so that individuals who are paralyzed can interact with the world. It could be communication for people who can't speak, or it could be simple interaction with devices like computers so that they can control their own world.
It could also be linked to a device such as the systems being worked on by Peckham's group, which would allow the brain signals of paralysis victims to directly control body motions, thereby creating a new link from brain to limb to replace the one severed by the injury. Donahue said he's working with Peckham's group on just such a project. Whatever the specific application, the miniaturization allowed by new technologies and materials again lies at the heart of the system.
The device itself is the size of a baby aspirin. It's a platform that's 4 by 4 millimeters, and it has 100 hair-thin probes that come out of it in a 10-by-10 array. And they stick about a millimeter into the brain and pick up brain signals. They're actually not that complicated in and of themselves. They're basically a conductor, mostly coated, but at the tip they're not. And that's where they pick up broadcasts from neurons. And then there's cabling that takes it outside the body. The ridiculously complicated part is the need to take what is basically a cart full of electronics and put it inside the body. And we're actually working on that, reducing something the size of a cigar box down to something that's smaller than your fingernail.
Donahue notes that there are still a variety of challenges to overcome for BrainGate in miniaturization, consistency, and the decoding algorithms that allow the noisy activity of the brain to be converted into a reliable control signal or output function. But he believes that BrainGate could start to become useful enough to be commercialized within a few years, with steady improvement thereafter.
BrainGate is a device that's going to keep developing more and more. So even if we can have some simple output function that's very crude compared to what we'd like to do, that could be a product that's out in just a few years. And then over the years, it will get more and more complex and provide more and more function. That'll, of course, go on for decades.
The session on smart prosthetics featured some other impressive work as well, including a prosthetic approach developed by Mark Humayun and colleagues for treating certain types of blindness resulting from retinal diseases, such as macular degeneration and retinitis pigmentosa, in which the retina's surface photoreceptors are degenerated, but the inner retinal cells remain intact. The device consists of an external collector, which appears superficially similar to a pair of sunglasses but includes a tiny video camera, and an internal grid of electrodes that stimulates the retinal cells based on signals from the camera, essentially taking the place of the lost photoreceptors. In early trials with a simple 16-electrode array, according to Humayun, formerly blind patients showed an ability to discriminate simple objects by sight that considerably outstripped his expectations. Trials are now underway with a larger 60-electrode grid, with the ultimate goal being a 1,000-electrode system that could restore something like real sight. Whatever advances lay in the future, though, smart prosthetic technologies as they exist today are already making a big difference for some patients. 9 years ago, Jennifer French fell off a 40-foot embankment while snowboarding and emerged from the accident a quadriplegic. Though told she would never walk or work again, the system devised by Hunter Peckham's group has allowed her to regain the ability to stand from her wheelchair and also a measure of trunk and limb control.
I mean, the world is not wheelchair accessible. It really isn't. I mean, you go to places where the door is not wide enough for a wheelchair to go into. I have an option where I can stand up, get out of my wheelchair, and go into a door that normally I wouldn't be able to. I'm able to use my trunk where I wouldn't be able to use my trunk. I can fold laundry, which is kind of a boring thing, but then you can also, you know, I can stand at a concert where you're standing around in a crowd where everyone else is standing and all I see is everyone's waist. Suddenly I can stand up and be eye level with everyone else. I mean, that's the social aspect of it, not just the functional aspect of it.
And that, says French, puts her in closer touch with her earlier non-paralyzed self.
When you're in a wheelchair, you're suddenly in a world where you're seated. If you just go into your office and mill around your office for a while with rolling your chair around, you'll realize that you have a very low level, and being able to just stand and be upright is just wonderful. You're suddenly back into a standing world that you knew before. And that's the thing with spinal cord injuries, is we always have in our head of where we were before we were injured. So suddenly you have this window into what it used to be like. So it was absolutely wonderful.
Advances such as smart prostheses rest in part on the development of new exotic materials, in particular nanomaterials. But nanomaterials also have their darker side. Their unusual properties have raised concerns about their safety. Vicky Colvin of the Rice University Department of Chemistry looked at the nature of those concerns and how to address them through smart science and design in one of the topical guest lectures at this year's AAAS annual meeting. I chatted with Dr. Colvin after the talk.
Vicki Colvin of Rice University, thanks very much for being with us today. In your talk this afternoon, you talked a little bit about sustainable nanotechnology. And let's break that down. What is nanotechnology, and what are the issues surrounding, you know, making it sustainable?
Well, nanotechnology is really a term that describes a wide range of technologies and that really exploit materials with nanometer scale dimensions. I think the U.S. government defines nano as roughly between 1 and 100 nanometers. So they're a very broad range of technologies that are fundamentally materials-based. So that's nanotechnology. It's very broad. You find it in everything from the automotive industry to your computer. And I think when you start to ask questions about sustainability, the decisions there are how do you create nanoscale materials with the lowest environmental impact in the manufacturing, and then also how do you ensure that during their use, all aspects of their use, they're safe and have very little impact on the people and other organisms that come into contact. And then, of course, how do you use them to create sustainable technology like in the energy, for example. So I think there's about those three facets of sustainability intersect nanotechnology.
And what let's home in on the safety issue. What in particular about nanomaterials is it that makes safety a potential issue with these things?
Well, I think in general they're new materials. They're a wide range of systems that are just new. And I think with anything that's a new type of material, whether it's a polymer or a nanoparticle or a new type of molecule, you have to think about safety. So in that sense, they're kind of conventional. But I think in the sense of biological impact, there's features surrounding the very small size of nanoparticles relative to larger scale materials might make them more biologically accessible. Certainly their large surface areas and also whatever chemical reactivity they have that's unique or different.
So essentially they're small enough where a protein molecule, for example, starts to look of comparable size.
Yeah, I think that when you think about it generally, things like viruses and small proteins have roughly the same size as nanoparticles. They're in the same range. That doesn't mean a priori that nanoparticles will behave like either one, but it means they can take advantage of transport mechanisms and processes in the body that are really designed for the length scale of biomolecules.
Can you provide some sort of specific examples of how, based on these properties, nanoparticles might cause issues in one or two biological or environmental systems?
Well, I guess one example might be, for example, nanoparticles can get taken up by cells through a process known as receptor-mediated endocytosis. And that process is one used by viruses. And because of the size of nanoparticles and particularly their surface chemistry, they can kind of, you know, take advantage of those pathways of entry into a cell. And if the nanoparticle is made of something which is intrinsically toxic, in the case of cadmium selenide systems, if you haven't done a very good job of protecting the particle and keeping it from dissolving, once it enters the cell, it can release free cadmium, which can have, of course, an impact and a toxic impact on a cell. So that's an example of one system where the intrinsic material itself we know has molecular toxicity. In the other case of finding a material that's completely benign when it's large, but when it's nano has a particular effect, I think that's a little bit harder. And perhaps some of the carbon nanosystems might be an example where when they're produced on the nanometer scale, they have both chemistry and biological properties, which are distinctive. And in some cases, those can be used for good. You can use it to do drug delivery, or you can use a carbon particle to actually kill a cell that you want to kill. And then the other flip side of that is if you haven't considered every aspect of how they're getting to the biological system, it can have an unanticipated effect on the health of an organism.
Looking at the toxicology of these materials, I think you mentioned in your talk today that these properties in themselves, in addition to having, you know, safety implications as you've described, make them kind of difficult to regulate. You brought up, for example, the issue of how you measure dose and how that becomes problematic.
Yeah, I think nanotechnology has stretched the limits of many disciplines that contacted. And in this case, a dose traditionally has been measured in terms of a mass, you know, a part per million or part per trillion kind of metric. And with a nanoparticle, if you're comparing it to bulk materials, you probably don't want a mass, because for the same gram of a nanomaterial as compared to a bulk, you have orders of magnitude more particles and lots more surface area. So rethinking how we measure dose is going to be a big part of understanding how to manage any risks that might come up from exposure.
Well, let's look at that. What do we do about this?
Well, I think that it's a complicated problem, and the technical scientific answers are an important piece of figuring out how to manage the risks, because you have to identify them and understand them. But I also believe that the larger issues of how scientists communicate to society and handle that communication are important. So from a technical point of view, if we understand the mechanisms by which particles are transformed by the biological environment and interact with it, we can design our particles to take advantage of that or to, for example, exhibit mechanisms that after they've done some function, they can actually degrade themselves or take themselves into a particular form that we know is non-toxic. And so that's one example of a safety by design idea, which uses understanding the structure of a nanoparticle and how it interacts with the biological setting to actually create very safe systems and safe technologies.
But you mentioned another point, which is how you communicate these risks. And I mean, what I'm hearing from you is that, yes, nanotechnology or nanomaterials present a number of unique issues that could be hazardous, but by factoring these issues into material design, we might be able to get around these. But then there's the whole issue of public perception. We hear stories about, you know, gray goo and apocalyptic tales about what nanomachines are going to lead to. How do we get past that aspect?
Well, I think that as long as people are interested in a good story, they're going to be journalists who write about gray goo, because it's a pretty good story. But it's just that, it's a story. And it's fiction, and finding a way to educate the public and convey the complexities of these scientific questions is one of our major challenges in the area. And I think that's going to take not just hoping that the media and people who cover these stories are educated, but as scientists being very proactive in working to explain some very difficult and complex ideas to people everywhere, and understanding how to do that really effectively, ideally in partnership with individuals who have more expertise in science communication, but also just realizing that in perhaps this area more than any other area of nanotechnology, we have to pay attention closely to how we communicate with the public.
Well, Vicki Coldman, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Stuart.
The theme of this year's AAAS annual meeting is Science and Technology for Sustainable Well-Being. That theme was struck forcefully by the president of AAAS, Dr. John Holdren of Harvard University, in the presidential keynote address that opened up the conference. Holdren focused on the large-scale challenges for human happiness and well-being, challenges that, he notes, don't exist in isolation from each other.
I think in particular that the great problems of the human condition, the problems of population, resources, environment, health, prosperity, security, are not separate problems but are intimately interconnected, and that if they're not addressed and solved together, they may not be solved at all.
In thinking about the role of science and technology in fostering sustainable well-being, Holdren framed four broad challenges: meeting the basic needs of the poor, managing competition for scarce natural resources, mastering what Holdren calls the energy economy environment dilemma, and moving to a world free of nuclear weapons. Many of the world's environmental problems, he stressed, have a strong economic dimension. For example, Holdren noted the failure of society to exact any economic cost for destroying natural resources and services as lying at the heart of much environmental abuse.
In a competition among a variety of human uses that are priced in the marketplace and a set of human uses that are not priced in the marketplace, it does not take a PhD in economics to figure out which resources are going to be consumed and abused.
Economics also lies at the heart of what Holdren called the energy economy environment dilemma.
The essence of that dilemma is that reliable and affordable energy is, on the one hand, essential to meeting basic human needs and fueling economic growth, but on the other hand, it is the source of many of the most difficult and dangerous environmental problems at every level of economic development and at every scale from the local to the global. Problems arising from the harvesting, the transport, the processing, and the conversion of energy. Energy supply specifically is the source of most indoor and outdoor air pollution, the source of most radioactive waste, source of much of the hydrocarbon and trace metal pollution of soil and groundwater, the source of essentially all of the oil that humans add to the oceans. and the source of most of the human-caused emissions of greenhouse gases that are altering the global climate. After 35 years of reflecting on this predicament, I have concluded that environment is the heart of the energy problem, and energy is the heart of the environment problem, and the intersection of energy, the economy, and the environment is the most vexing problem in the sustainable prosperity picture for developing and industrialized countries alike.
If current trends continue, Holdren noted, world energy use will be 4 times as big in 2100 as in 2000, a level unlikely to be sustained by an increasingly overloaded environment.
The sustainability problem, it turns out, with the business-as-usual energy path is not that we're running out of energy in any absolute sense. There's actually plenty of energy out there in coal, in oil shale, in uranium, in solar energy, in wind, to run an even bigger world than the one we're heading for in the year 2100 under business-as-usual. The sustainability problem is rather that we're running out of cheap and easy liquid fuels to put in our cars and airplanes, and we're running out of environment, in the sense of the environment's capacity to absorb without intolerable consequences the effluence and the impacts of mobilizing and using this energy in the forms and with the technologies that we use today.
The most visible manifestation of that overloaded environment, of course, is global climate change.
The Earth is getting warmer. 2005 was the hottest year in the 125-year instrumental record. The 13 hottest years all occurred since 1990. 23 out of the 24 hottest all occurred since 1980. And we know why the Earth has been getting hotter.
While Holdren's address offered a devastating catalog of the challenges to the planet and to humanity's long-term well-being, it was also a call to arms to the world's scientists to rise to those challenges. He concluded his address with a direct appeal to scientists that drew sustained applause.
I believe that individual scientists and technologists need to read more and think more about fields and problems outside their normal area of specialization. Scientists and technologists need to improve their communication skills so that they can convey the relevant essence of their understandings to members of the public and to policymakers. They need to seek out avenues for doing that. And I believe that every scientist and technologist should tithe 10% of his or her professional time and effort to working to increase the benefits of science and technology for the human condition and to decrease the liabilities. The challenges demand no less. Thank you very much.
That wraps up this special edition of the Science Podcast. Tomorrow, in another AAAS annual meeting edition of the show, we'll find out what Google founder Larry Page had to say in his plenary address, explore the scientific, social, and policy dilemmas of hunting and fighting killer asteroids, and chat with Stanford's Robert Sapolsky about stress, health, and coping. I'm Stuart Wills, the online editor of Science, on behalf of the journal and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Thanks for joining us.